Hey, welcome to Breitbart News Daily. I'm Mike Slater. Thanks for being here. Slater Radio on the Twitter and the Instagram. I want to kick off here with a guest we had, Michael Barry from the American First Policy Institute. We're trying to figure out what the best, like how much to talk about Trump, the Trump trial, moving forward, because it's so ridiculous, as we will talk about here. It's so, right, but you can't not talk about it because it is interesting. But also, if we cede the ground completely and ignore it because it's so dumb and pointless and don't be distracted, the left will just totally railroad. I mean, it's already a railroad job, but like totally railroad and control the entirety of the narrative. And we can't allow that either, because they may control the narrative for the country, but you control the narrative in your circle. So you, if we are armed with the facts that the statute of limitations ran out and what a gag order normally is used for, that the judge gave Joe Biden money and a group called Stop Republicans, right? Like if we know these things, then you can spread the word to your circle of friends and combat the narrative like that. So like we need to find the right balance between talking about it and not talking about it. Anyway, here is Michael Barry. We didn't talk about the Trump case. We haven't in the last 2 days or so. So I want to go to Michael Barry, who's the executive director of the Center for Litigation at the America First Policy Institute. Michael, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Good to talk to you. Thanks for being here. So give us the, I think we're all pretty up to speed, at least on what the accusations and charges are. I got some more in-depth questions beyond that, but just make sure we're on the same page here. Give us the 30-second pitch of what this trial is about. What's he accused of, and et cetera?
Well, I wish there were a 30-second answer to that, but I'll do my best. It's a bit of a show trial, right? I mean, that's really what's going on here. The easiest way to explain it is this is a bookkeeping error that you or me or any number of people could make, and it's really not even a crime, right? Because the Department of Justice at the federal level looked at this and said it's not a crime. You had other analysts look at this, that the Federal Elections Commission, when they tried to say, well, this is a campaign finance violation, the FEC looked at it and said, no, right, there's nothing here, move on. But of course, we are entering an election year, so the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, has taken it upon himself to say, oh no, this is a felony. We must charge President Donald Trump with a felony and hold the trial just months before the election. Oh, and by the way, I need to pull one of the Department of Justice's top prosecutors away from Washington, D.C. to, you know, to Manhattan in order to hire him and try this case. So it's, you know, it's anybody's guess as to exactly what their theory is, because if you read the charges and then you hear what they're saying in court, they don't match up, right? Mm. So they're trying to say that now that this is some sort of conspiracy to steal the 2016 election. So again, your guess is as good as mine, but at the end of the day, what they've actually charged President Trump with is a bookkeeping, a clerical error, and now they're trying to say that that's somehow a felony that was an attempt to steal the 2016 election.
And to be clear, the paying of $130,000 of hush money to Stormy Daniels, that question, is that a campaign expense violation? That went in front of the FEC, and they chose, did they make a ruling on it, or did they just say nothing about it?
They didn't make a formal ruling because there was nothing to rule on. They just said, this isn't even worth our time. I think it was yesterday, there was a law professor who wrote an opinion, I think it was in the New York Times even, I mean, of all places, and he said, hush money might be unseemly, but it's legal. Right, it's you are allowed to use money, even campaign money, to pay somebody for what's called a non-disclosure agreement. A non-disclosure agreement is something that you and I and millions of others have probably signed more times in our lives than we want to, but it's part of everyday life to do business in this country.
So that's the basis, and because what Trump should have written in his ledger, hush money payment or something in his New York business records? Like what would Trump have had to have done in order for the Alvin Bragg to admit that it was all on the up and up or something. You know what I mean? Like, what would it have to have looked like?
I mean, the real answer to that question is Donald Trump would have had to have withdrawn from the election, right? From running for president. That's pretty much the only thing that he could have done to avoid this. Because that's what the other side is already saying out loud, is that if he weren't running for president, none of this would be happening to him. But I mean, the technical answer is, yeah, I suppose he could have exactly written in his campaign ledger, I am paying this money to keep somebody quiet because I don't want to be publicly humiliated and embarrassed or something like that, right? So that they could then use that to publicly humiliate and embarrass him, which is exactly the point.
Is his lawyers denying that he paid the money?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we've gotten that far in the trial yet. I think what this is really about is number one, this is not a felony, even if it does rise to the level of a crime. And the evidence of any criminality here is very, very suspect at best, right? So it's not even clear whether there's evidence of a crime. And then even if there is the evidence, any crime that was committed is a misdemeanor whose statute of limitations ran out long ago, right? I mean, years ago. And so the only way that they can shoehorn this in to make it fit is to now try to tie it to the 2016 election to say that it's a campaign finance violation. And, oh, now all of a sudden it rises to the level. So it's like a conspiracy to commit a conspiracy to commit a conspiracy to steal the election. And that's, you know, and if you listen to the legacy media talk about it, it's like they're all acting in concert, which is, again, another easy tell, right, is that they all use the same language. They talk about scheme. They talk about conspiracy. They talk about conspiracy to commit fraud and steal the election. So they're all saying the exact same thing. So they're all working from the same sheet of music.
Sure. What's the statute of limitations for this crime?
That I could not tell you. I'm not a New York licensed attorney, but I mean, typically for something like that, for a low level misdemeanor, you're talking anywhere from, you know, 2 to 4 years is the typical range.
Okay.
So we're 8 years out. Happened, this was, you know, way longer ago than that.
So 8 years ago, but the reason they were able to get around that is because of the claim that it was done in the act of committing a different crime, which is the campaign finance violation. That's how they were able to zap it back to life.
Yeah, I mean, that's the shoehorning it in, right, to a different crime that would be, you know, if it were actually fit there, then it would possibly rise to the level of a conspiracy to, you know, to commit this bigger crime. No. And of course, at the felony level, the statute of limitations is typically much longer. You're talking 10 years or longer.
But is this jury going to rule on whether a campaign finance violation occurred? They can't answer that question, can they? Aren't they only going to be asked, did he forge his business documents, right?
Well, I mean, that's the fascinating thing. You listen to the opening statements yesterday, you'd think that that's what this is about, right? That this is actually about a referendum on the 2016 election, because that's what it sounded like. You know, I mean, I wasn't physically there, but I was able to catch some pieces of the opening statements. And I got to say, by the way, this Judge Merchan, I mean, the way that he's going after President Trump's attorneys is stuff that like, it's something that you would see on a sitcom or something like that on TV or in film. Because as an attorney who's practiced for years and I've been in front of more judges than I can count, I don't think I've ever had a judge, you know, dress me down that way or even my opposing counsel in court the way that he did. I mean, he literally interrupted him and said, you're losing your credibility, you're losing your credibility, and said it. And obviously now that's all public, so that's going to take you know, your question was whether he's going to get a fair trial and whether the trial's actually going to be on the facts. I don't know how it's possible for Donald Trump to get a fair trial in Manhattan with number one, the just this judge, and number two, with the pool of jurors that exist there, and then number three, with the way that the judge is treating President Trump's attorneys and the gag order. I mean, it's like you could go on. I mean, it's just you can list one thing after another to demonstrate that this is what I would expect to happen in Russia, North Korea, Iran, China, things like that. These show trials, that's I wouldn't be shocked, right? If I'd seen what's happening in this case and you told me, oh, this is in Pyongyang, North Korea. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, that's what happens there. This is the United States of America. And you have a judge, you know, dressing down an attorney, and it's now public, and basically saying you have no credibility. How on earth is a defendant, a criminal defendant in the United States of America, supposed to get a fair trial in a situation like that?
Do you know the exact context of the judge saying you're losing all credibility with the court?
Yeah, he was asking the attorney to give him legal precedent, right? So tell me what authority exists, because they were talking about and this had to do with the gag order. So again, start with the gag order, which in and of itself I believe is unconstitutional. Okay,
yeah, let's start with that. What is a gag order, and what is it normally used for, and how is it used here?
A gag order is typically issued by a court to and it's usually issued to everybody involved in the case, both sides, right? Your attorneys, your witnesses, the defendant, you know, the plaintiff, etc. And it's basically nobody say anything about this case, because we don't want to improperly taint the jury. We don't want to – basically, we don't want to air the dirty laundry publicly outside the courtroom. We want to keep everything inside the courtroom so nobody's allowed to say anything.
Is this a common thing? Do judges do that a lot?
No. I mean, it's usually if it's something highly sensitive, or a lot of times if it's involving salacious details that is unnecessary for it to get out, or – if it involves, sensitive, classified, information or something like that. And so basically they don't want that information just going out, being public, because, in America, our court trials are public. So the judge can issue a gag order and basically say, nobody talk about this. Now, the difference in this case is the gag order only applies to one side and one side only. It only applies to President Trump and his lawyers. It doesn't apply to Alvin Bragg. It doesn't apply to anyone else involved, to Michael Cohen. It only applies to Donald Trump and his lawyers. And so you've got legal experts on both sides of the political spectrum looking at this thing. How on earth is that fair, right? To basically tell and remember, we in our Constitution, the entire system of criminal justice in this country is set up to ensure that the defendant receives a fair trial, right? You are presumed innocent until you're proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt, the highest legal standard known in the law. And yet to say, well, you're not allowed to talk about the case, you can't. He's like, I don't want bad mouthing any of the people. And then you see it, like the witnesses, and then you see what Michael Cohen goes on social media and just goes on a tirade and is name calling and is defaming Donald Trump, and knowing that there's absolutely nothing that Trump can do in response because of this gag order. So that's the backdrop, okay? So President Trump, of course, is prolific on social media, on the app known as Truth Social, right? But all he did in this instance yesterday, where the judge was trying to decide whether Trump had violated the gag order, is to say that he had reposted something, and I think we're all familiar with the concept of reposting, right? Where you're not creating any new content. You just see something and you can literally just click a little button and it automatically just, it's like a repeater. So the judge was basically saying, well, that violates the gag order, doesn't it? And President Trump's attorney was arguing, no, it doesn't violate the gag order. Reposting something is not the same thing as saying whatever it is that he was accused to have said. And the judge asked him, what legal precedent, what Supreme Court case says that reposting something isn't violating a gag order? Well, I mean, I don't even know how long Truth Social's been around, maybe 4 or 5 years, right? The concept of reposting hasn't been around that long. There's not going to be any legal precedent, right? There's just not. I mean, but yet the judge just started going after him for saying, well, Your Honor, I'm not really aware of like a Supreme Court case that says, because he was demanding, no, what case says what you're saying? And he was like, well, I'm really not aware of any case, Your Honor, which is a perfectly reasonable answer for an attorney to give. Okay, I've given that answer in court many times, and the judges say, I'd rather you tell me I don't know than make something up. Well, apparently that's not the case here, because the judge went after President Trump's attorney and was just like, well, you're losing credibility because you don't know the answer. Well, so again, it's yeah. all goes back to it's a show trial. It's not a fair trial. It's never going to be a fair trial. But you know what? It's not. That's not the point. The point is not whether or not Donald Trump is guilty or innocent in this case. I mean, that's obviously it is in the discrete sense. But really, what this is really about, it's about Joe Biden, who knows that every day that Donald Trump is tied up in court in New York, in D.C., at the Supreme Court, in Florida, wherever, is a day that he can't spend on the campaign trail. Every day that Donald Trump, every dollar that Donald Trump spends on his lawyers, see, legal fees, defending himself, right, is a dollar that he can't spend on the campaign trail. And that is what this is really about, yeah. because the left is saying the quiet part out loud now. If Donald Trump had simply decided not to run for re-election, none of this would be happening. I mean, they're actually saying that now. And so we all know that that's what this is about.
Yeah, the process is the punishment, no question. So let's say in let's say it was a fair jury, which is impossible. What exactly would the jury, what exactly are they answering? What question are they answering? What are they exactly going to rule on? And again, they're trying to muddy the waters with conspiracy and crime in 2016 and this whole thing. But what exactly, if they follow the letter of the law as they're supposed to do, what are they trying to exactly answer?
Well, that's a great question, because that's the part that a lot of the lawyers and legal wonks like me are going to be paying very close attention to. And that is, what are the instructions that the judge is going to give the jury when they finally return to the, yes. to the jury room for deliberations, right? In different courts have different terms. Some people call them findings instructions, right? So it's basically like this is how you are now supposed to decide this case, jury, right? Based on all the evidence, or the evidence is, it's all in there. The lawyers made all their statements, their closing arguments, et cetera. All the evidence has been presented. Now, based on everything you've just seen and heard, these are your instructions. You were to go back in that room and you were to decide whether Donald Trump is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And again, it's all based on what is actually the what is he charged with. It's not, I mean, it's the old saying that we lawyers say is, I don't care what you're mad about, right? Yes. What yes, can yes. you prove, right? And so they're mad about everything. They're mad that he's yeah. running for president, ultimately, as yes. I've said before. But what can they prove? And what is he actually charged with? And do those things match up? And what he's charged with is this bookkeeping error that you and I, you know, have discussed, yeah. right? This
so
failure
may
to
be guilty
say,
of that.
I paid hush money.
Can the jury come back and say he is guilty of a bookkeeping error, and that's his punishment is a misdemeanor and $100 fine? Like, is that, could that be it?
Yeah, I mean, it could. Yes, there could be the proverbial slap on the hand, right? There could be. But you said it best, right? The process is the punishment. It's not about, I don't think that Alvin Bragg cares about the conviction or not. Ultimately, mm-hmm. I'm sure he would love to get the conviction just to be able to say that he convicted Donald yeah. Trump. Right. But remember, this is the same district attorney who released a memo saying there's whole categories of crimes that his office would not prosecute in New York City. Just that's his policy. He's not going to prosecute people who sell marijuana. He's not going to prosecute prostitution. He's not going to prosecute people who resist arrest. Okay, so I mean, think about the lawlessness that message that is sending. But yet somehow you make a mistake on your bookkeeping, a clerical error, and he's going to throw the book at you.
I think he thinks that he
doesn't stand a chance of actually winning this case in a real court, right? Yeah. But again, it's not about winning or losing. No. It's about keeping Donald Trump away from campaigning and giving the left and Joe Biden and everyone else the opportunity to distract from the border, to distract from the crime wave that's happening, right? The riots and protests at Columbia University and elsewhere, they said, don't look over there. Pay no attention to that. Look at the man who's sitting trial in Manhattan. Look at the man who's got a case in front of the Supreme Court on Thursday, mm-hmm. right? And that's what they want everybody to focus on.
Totally. Okay. One more question about the case yesterday or the day before. The catch and kill aspect of this. So a catch and kill story, correct me if I'm wrong, is in this case, the National Enquirer pays someone, in this case, Stormy Daniels, X amount of money for the exclusive to a story. We're the exclusive. You can't tell anyone else this story. We're paying you money so you just tell us so we can sell magazines. So we're going to catch the story, and then we are not going to publish it. We're going to kill it because we want to help our guy, Donald Trump over here. If that happened, is that illegal?
I don't think so. I mean, it's not necessarily my area of legal expertise, but if somebody's willing to enter into a binding contract to do that, then sure, you can do that, right? I mean, how is that any different than a non-disclosure agreement, right? I'm agreeing to not disclose this information to anyone else except for you, whatever the publication is. And if that publication says, oh, you know what, we've actually decided we've got other things we want to cover instead.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. They don't have any obligation to publish it.
So why was Ms. Michael, is it Michael Pecker? Whatever his first name is. Why was he the head of the National Enquirer? Why was he questioned? What's the big deal about this guy? What's his role in all this?
It's a bit of a fishing expedition, right? I mean, you're, and it's all for show. I mean, it's all for show. They trot him out there, and they want to know, you know, what do you know? And again, they're going to try to use little buzzwords, you know, like conspiracy, scheme to defraud, conspiracy to defraud, conspiracy to steal an election. And lawyers, they often refer to this as spaghetti, right? You throw everything you've got at the wall and you see what sticks. So that's what's going on here. It's nothing, right? It's to say it's making a mountain out of a molehill. It's making Mount Everest out of a molehill. Yeah.
Anything coming up next that we need to look forward to in this trial? Anything of significance? Stormy Daniels, that'll be a big news story for the day, et cetera. Anything that you're looking forward to?
Well, I think the judge is going to rule on the gag order violation, right? And he's already said that he's got a lot of options available to him for how to punish Donald Trump if he finds that he violated the gag order. And he's already, I think he even said he does not plan to issue that ruling from the bench. In other words, there's going to be something written that everybody can read. And that will be pretty important to see. Mm. Okay. I mean, sort of like what the judge did to the defense counsel, right? It's like, oh, what authority do you have, judge, to say that you can't repost something on social media, right? What authority do you have to issue a gag order against only the defendant, right? And no one else, not even witnesses who are out there defaming the defendant publicly. So I think a lot of people are going to watch that and be very curious to see what he does with that.
How long do you think this whole thing will last?
You know, that's a great question. I think based on the fact that we are heading into the election, they just want to run, you know, string this thing out long enough to keep Trump off the campaign trail. So I can all but assure you it'll end before November 5th. You know, I think magically, right as we get to November, all of a sudden, things are going to start moving along and wrapping up. But, you know, I would say it's going to drag out through the summer for sure.
Oh, no way. Really? So it's not a 4-week thing?
It certainly could be, right? It certainly could be. But look how long it's taken this far just to get to this point. I mean, just opening statements has always had. I mean, that's if you're talking about a marathon of 26.2 miles, we've basically just hit the first mile.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. Michael Berry, Executive Director of the Center for Litigation at the America First Policy Institute. Michael, good to talk to you, sir. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. There you go. What a joke. Listen, I'm trying to find the right balance of covering this and you know, not covering it. My John Stewart did a funny bit on The Daily Show about the breathless coverage of the lamestream, covering every single split second of it and covering his drive from Trump Towers to the courthouse as if it's a car chase. What is just commute? And what is he wearing? And what is he looking like? And is he falling asleep? And I have no interest in any of that nonsense. But if anything, I almost don't even want to call it noteworthy. I don't know. It's like, it's weird. Like, is it noteworthy? Like, no, it's so stupid, but also kind of a huge deal that the front runner for president is, you know, that they're dragging him through this. So trying to find the right balance of how to cover and not cover here. Hopefully we hit that sweet spot. But my personal care about this case ended immediately at the judge donated money to Joe Biden and donated money to a group called Stop Republicans. That right there, it's like all you need to know. I don't care what happens beyond there. It's all a joke. There's no question about that. We're going to Russ, who's in New York. What's going on, Russ?
Hey, Mike. I'm not a lawyer. I mean, as lawyers go, I'm one hell of a farmer. But I think what the legal pundits are overlooking in this is the fact that they want to get this wrapped up as fast as possible, because what Marchand can say is, you've been found guilty, so I know you're going to file an appeal. I can't send you to jail, but you don't get to leave the state of New York. You've got a lovely place to live in Manhattan while you wait your appeal, and as part of my ruling, you don't get to leave New York because you're
right?
a flight risk. You have your own plane, so they can essentially eliminate him from the campaign trail by locking him down in New York.
Is that true? Like, so they can keep him in New York. Do you know that to be true, or is that a...
But yeah, that's, I mean, you think about it. All these cases where people are found guilty and they say you have to surrender your passport, you can't leave the state without permission from your parole officer, everything like that. And they can just get a Democrat operative parole officer to say, nope, you don't get to leave.
All right, let me inquire on that one. That one's very interesting. Russ, I appreciate that. Because, yeah, now you don't have to drag the case out forever. You can just find him guilty quick, done. And just keep them in New York anyway, even without the case ongoing. All right, that's interesting. Let me ask some lawyer friends about that one. Welcome back to Breitbart News Daily. So I planned on talking about the college protests that are going on right now and how crazy it is. And I just threw off as an aside here, and you'll hear, hey, how's your college experience going with your kids? And we got into a whole thing. I just want to play the first segment here. We took phone calls a whole hour. I don't know if in this hour is the gentleman from Tennessee. It may have been in the second segment. Where he called and he's like, I don't know what to do with my high school senior. He doesn't know, and we don't know if he should go into welding school or go to school and become a marine biologist. What's your advice? And we opened up the phones to that, and it was great. So here's the first segment of that hour. Do your kids go to college? How are your kids doing in college right now? I'm curious what your kids' college experience is at the moment. 866-95-PATRIOT. Just in general, this can be related to the pro-Hamas rallies that are taking place on your kid's college campus, or just general insanity. My oldest is 7, so I got 11 years before hopefully the entire system collapses and I don't have to, he doesn't have to go to, or there are already other options, and I hope he takes one of them. I was talking to someone who's she runs a school in town, and I said, oh, how many kids do your school go to Ivy League schools? And she said, who cares? I can't even see it. She's like, I don't know, like I think they've had a few, but they're like, that's not even, like, that is not a goal, which is crazy, because that used to be the pinnacle of going, like, of course you would. And it's like, no, we would advise against it, actually. My alma mater had a celebration just this last week, and it was 150 years of the swim team. Swim team celebrated their 150th anniversary, so there's a big reunion. I didn't go, but I saw a lot of pictures. It looked like some fun. I only have good memories of college. I liked it a lot. College is totally wasted on the youth. College, and this is impossible, but college should be a thing that you go to when you're 30. You should graduate high school, live for a while, and then go to college, because you would actually appreciate it and you would enjoy it in real ways and you would actually read the books. It doesn't make any sense. You can't do that way, but... right now, it's just 13th grade. It's a total joke. College is a total joke. I always have to put an asterisk on that because whenever I say that, I always get some angry email from some mom saying, oh, my daughter's pre-med and she worked very hard at organic chemistry. Great. Your daughter's a hard worker. For the most part, college is a total joke. Absolute joke. Now, before I prove my point with numbers on how college is a joke, I saw a picture of the sit-ins at Yale. They took over one of the main intersections on campus. And it's hilarious. It's because you got the you got your hippie bongo drummers in the middle of the intersection banging on the drums all day with one guy who's high on something, dancing or whatever this is, convulsing around in the middle of the street, and everyone's just sitting on the curb. It's like they got drum circles going on. It's so piteous. Is that the word? It's like disheartening. Like, oh, this is Yale. This is, like that's. So you have that. You have the foolishness of it, right? A lot of student performances taking place in these Gaza encampments. I saw a video of a musicless dance routine. Oh, it was all very moving. And then it gets violent. This is one of the chants at Columbia. We played it yesterday. Al-Qassam, you make us proud. A terrorist group, take another soldier out. We say justice, you say how. Burn Tel Aviv to the ground. Hamas, we love you. So listen, we don't need to have any, like, oh, well, what are their real thoughts about the plight? Or this is really about the poor Palestinian people. Hamas, we love you. We support your rockets too. Red, black, green, and white, we support Hamas's fight. It's pretty clear. It's the right to rebel, Al-Qassam. Give them hell. It's the right to rebel. Hamas, give them hell. Free, free, free Palestine. Okay. So you got that going on. Columbia canceling classes in person. It's all online now. This is great. The president wrote to the students. Students, this is to the to everyone, the campus, right? The Columbia University president. Students across an array of communities have expressed fear for their safety. That's so good. An array of communities. It's the Jews. For good reason, too, by the way. I will go back to Exhibit 3. Hamas, we love you. We support your rockets, too. Al-Qassam, give him hell. That would be my example of how a Jew on campus would be fearful for their safety. But I love the array. Oh, it's an array of communities. So of Columbia, 23% of students are Jewish and 16% of the grad students. That's a lot of Jews on campus at Columbia. That's a lot. It's not like five Jewish kids on campus. 23% of the student body. That's a lot of people. Right? That's a big group. And there's also a lot of people who hate that big group on campus. Yet the president said students across an array of communities have expressed fear for their safety. No. Just the Jews. Because only the Jews have an understandable fear for their safety. I would have no fear walking through campus. They're not threatening me directly. You with me? I'm not in that 25% of the student body. But the fact that the president can't say Jewish, can't say Jews, can't dare to be truthful about where exactly the hate is being spewed, the violence is being spewed, and instead takes this pathetic, oh, it's an array of communities. The array. What other group feels threatened by from the river to the sea? What, where in the array? Like it's a charcuterie of students that are offended. Oh, where in the charcuterie board? Where in this array of students, Columbia? What other group? This is anti-arrayism. We have the pro-Hamas people are anti-array. Stop it. Anti-arrayism. And now the faculty's in on it too. This is the faculty at Barnard marching into the president's office.
No suspensions! Now!
What do we want?
No suspensions!
That's the faculty. That's great. Someone wrote, they want it to be 1968 so bad they can taste it. Unfortunately, their time machine landed in 1939 in Germany. It's pretty good. All right, I got a lot more to say, but I'd rather take your phone calls here. I want to go to Jane and Mark, if you guys can hang on. Let's go to Jerry first. Jerry, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing this morning?
Good, brother. I asked the question, your kids on college campuses, how are they doing? What are they seeing, et cetera? What about you?
Well, you know, my daughter just graduated, so she's not currently enrolled, but we have very recent experience. And she went to North Carolina State and went in very conservative and came back progressively liberal each time she came back home. And now she's quite liberal. Her boyfriend is quite liberal. She came home with the coexist bumper sticker over a rainbow flag on her car. Although I did combat that, I got a coexist sticker for my car, but all the letters are made out of guns and hand grenades. So,
fire with fire.
Onto that.
What? So, are you being for real with this story? This actually, this is a real thing. This actually happened.
My younger daughter, college, decided she was done with school, just wanted to go into the workforce. My younger daughter's coming around and is starting to realize what's going on in her world. And her boyfriend are getting quite conservative, and that she won't talk to her sister about it. We hired together, that went directly into the workforce is conservative. The one that went to college has been indoctrinated.
Wow. So you have a case study. You have an actual like control group case study on what happened with your two girls. That's amazing. Why were you concerned about this when you sent your daughter off to NC State?
Well, you know, I wasn't concerned when she went because I figured, you know, even though North Carolina has been kind of purple in elections, I figured, you know, that NC State, you know, is not really that liberal of a school. Now, University of North Carolina, very liberal, but I guess the people that she surrounded herself with, and she was around a lot of the marching band. She was in marching band for a while, and I guess when you get into music and things like that, you run into a different crowd. And it was kind of odd that she got indoctrinated the way she did because she went into a very analytical field. She went into engineering. And so I was quite surprised that she would come home and, you know, and now they're totally anti, you know, conservative. They're pro $20 an hour minimum wage. You know, I mean, her boyfriend even talks about how great things are in Cuba. And I keep telling him, hey, look, I grew up in Miami. You know what? Why don't you go move to Cuba and see how it is down there?
Wow, that's amazing. Jerry, thanks for the call, man. I'm sorry about that. Sorry that happened to your daughter. But everyone knows you got to watch out for the marching band Marxist. Everyone knows the marching band is the most Marxist group. that's bizarre. I wouldn't have thought the marching band is like, watch out for them. Yeah, that's... man, you're sending them off. You're sending them off into the lion's den. There's no question about it. The snake pit maybe is a better analogy. Let's go to Mark, who's in Virginia. What's going on, Mark?
Hey, how you doing? Can you hear me?
Really good. Yeah, sure, Cam. What's what about your kid in college?
Yeah, so two sons. One just graduated a couple years ago from Virginia Tech. The other's a rising senior there. Both brought up fairly much in a conservative household. The grandparents on one side, very liberal, but very mainstream liberal, good folks. So he gets to see how people can have different opinions and not be, you know, extreme. Other grandparent lives overseas, shockingly voted for Obama twice, shocked me. But when confronted with the choice between Trump and Clinton, there was no question. Now solidly in the Trump camp, back to being a conservative, thank God. So the kids went to school, basically conservatives, but having an appreciation for all sides. And we were just there this weekend visiting, and the largest commotion that we saw on that campus, right in the heart at the drill field, was the Relay for Life.
That's
no
good.
Crazy Hamas agitators. It was raising money for cancer. You know, not that there isn't some of that on that campus. I'm sure there is. But for the most part, it's fairly mainstream. I told your screener that, you know, my son's got a couple of weapons there, lives off campus. They had this mass shooting there. Of course, we went and saw the memorial every time we visit. It's a reminder. It's a reminder that those who are not armed are vulnerable, and those who understand the principle of self-defense at least have a chance. Mm. He loves sports shooting. Loves sports shooting and, you know, outdoors, being outdoors. And I'm just thrilled that they both decided to go to Virginia Tech and not UVA or some other place where a little bit more left-leaning.
It sounds like you sent them off with the right principles as well and then sent them off to a good place.
Yes.
Yeah. Mark, yep. I appreciate that, man. Very good. This actually is a perfect time. I got rebuked yesterday. We went all in on Oklahoma yesterday. And I went in on Oklahoma's the reddest state in the country, and it's the only state in the country where every single county voted red. And I got rebuked. I was wrong. I would like to make a correction to the record here. West Virginia is the reddest. Now, this is Virginia Tech. It's in Blacksburg, but it's right on the border there. We'll count it as it's basically West Virginia. West Virginia is even redder than Oklahoma. Even Oklahoma, Oklahoma City was close. It was like 49-48, Oklahoma City, that county. For Trump. So it was very close, but in West Virginia, there's nowhere even close. And their state legislature is even more Republican. So West Virginia, we're counting on you. Well done, Virginia Tech. We'll go to Jane, who's in Wisconsin. Jane, how are you?
Hi, good morning.
What is your kid's college experience right now?
I think that my son has gone to the best college in the country right now. He is a senior at Hillsdale College in Lower Michigan.
Nice.
He is not dealing with any of this nonsense. He was a senior at the 2020 COVID, had a horrible ending to his senior year of high school. And I was so thankful that he got a scholarship to go to Hillsdale. And they have not done any of this nonsense. It's just been a wonderful experience. I can't recommend the school more highly than it's just a wonderful place. They teach classes in Constitution. It's actually part of their core curriculum. Mm-hmm. You have to take a class in Constitution. He had to read a book about morals before he even entered as a freshman. I mean, yeah. It's just a wonderful place.
Yeah, that's great. Jane, thanks for the call. I remember when I first heard of Hillsdale, I don't know, 20 years ago. I didn't know what it was. I heard Rush talk about it. Rush was talking. And I was like, is it a real school? Like is it just an online thing, or like, I didn't know, I never heard of it. And now I can't wait to go. And I go visit it when our kids are touring colleges, and like, I can't wait to push it. That person I was talking to about a moment ago, when I was like, oh, do any of your kids go to Ivy League schools? She said, why? A lot of the kids from the school that she worked at go to Hillsdale. And Hillsdale is, my understanding is they're making a big push towards, I think they have a program actually, training adults to start classical Christian schools, K-12 classical Christian schools, which is what my kids do, and I can't recommend enough. So opening up more of these and having more options of classical Christian schools across the country, which would change the country. There's no question about it. As we talk on the show all the time about our founding grandfathers. Not just our founding fathers, but our founding grandfathers, the people who came before our founding fathers, who inspired our founding fathers. Our founding fathers had to come up in something. And they came up in the classical, with the great books. And they came up with the classical learning. We talked yesterday or Monday about Thomas Jefferson learning Latin at age 9. I think we quoted, did we do this? Did we quote, I think we did on Monday. Cicero, Thomas Jefferson's. So Cicero's daughter died, and he wrote this whole thing about grief. And then Thomas Jefferson's dad died when he was 14. And this was the part, this quote from Cicero was the quote that he used to comfort him. And when he was 60, he wrote a letter to some kids in Maine about life advice. And this was part of the life advice. And he read that in Latin when he was 14, right? So that's who our founding generation was. We were the most literate people in the world. And now we're not, like, we're like there's a high percentage of people who are not literate in this country. Like, let's start with that basic, right? But anyway, I have this impression that when I go visit Hillsdale, I'll walk around and say, oh, this is what college used to be. This is it. Like, this is what it used to be like, and it still exists. And maybe there's a few more places like that. Go to David, who's in Texas. Uh-oh, I don't like to hear what it says here on the call screen log. David, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
Real good, but I'm in Tennessee now, and it would be nice to send kids. So we used to, growing up, we used to have this thing that it didn't matter where you went to college, you go wherever you wanted across the country. But now I really want the kids to stay close for reasons we could talk about. But like Tennessee is right down the street, right? It's on the side of the state. That'd be a great place for my kids to go. But that's where your kid goes.
I lived in Tennessee for 10 years. When I retired from the Army, my ex-wife had moved down there. And my daughter went to magnet school in Murfreesboro. And I was really worried about sending my daughter to the University of Tennessee after hearing Phil Valentine, God rest his soul, talk about sending his sons to the University of Tennessee about the wokeness that he had experienced from his sons coming back. And I got to experience it. Both my ex-wife and I are very conservative. But my daughter graduated last year, went to the University of Tennessee, our flagship university, and got the liberal indoctrination brainwashing. And we are slowly trying to pull her out of that.
What is she thinking and saying?
A lot of the DEI, a lot of the, I'd say the feminized radical, the radical feminism liberalism, just with how she votes, how she view things, and she just got her first real adult job. So I'm hoping that when Uncle Sam and the taxes really start in on her, that she'll realize that all that stuff that she was taught there isn't true.
Yeah. How does she feel about you?
She, again, like all younger generations, you just don't understand. You didn't experience what I experienced. You didn't go through what I went through. I saved a lot of money for her to go to college and for her to have that phenomenal, D1 experience, her on the dance team, her and her sorority. And it just it breaks my heart to see that.
Any idea where or who she was, what group she was in?
I think a lot of it was in her sorority. I think a lot of it, I think they have brainwashed. It's comforting to see that the Zoomer men are trending more conservative, but the Zoomer females with the things that they're putting out are trending more liberal, and see that.
That's going to create a weird disconnect soon when it comes to getting married time. David, I appreciate the call, and I'm really sorry to hear that. All right, this is interesting. I want to go to Tracy and Steve. Guys, if you can pull up both, but I'm trying to think who to go to first. Let's go to Steve first. I can pull up Steve. Okay, but get ready for Tracy. Steve, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Hey, this is a very prescient conversation because my son is a junior at a very good private school in Chattanooga, and my wife and I are struggling with, do we send him to college or to trade school? Because we don't want him to go to college and be indoctrinated by these lunatics. And we've raised him with good morals, but you never know what happens when you get on a college campus and what the gentleman before me just said, the influence of the young ladies on campus. So it's a struggle with us. Very big struggle.
Where's your son's, where's his head at?
Well, he leans conservative, but he's very open to all ideas because that's how we raised him.
Yep.
However, we do know that he can be influenced by his peer groups. We've seen it and we've had to check it sometimes. But he definitely does not like paying taxes. He had his first summer job. He learned a lesson.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. That his personality is one that is more open and influenced to peer groups. That's an interesting observation that you notice. And something you would have no control over when you send him off, obviously. I have no advice. Steve, can you hang on for a second? Let's go to Tracy in Massachusetts, who may have some advice for you. Tracy, how are you?
I'm well. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. So your kids are in college.
They are. So I have twins, actually. So they're sophomores, a boy and a girl. And one is in college in upstate New York in Syracuse at Lemoyne College, Jesuit school. He is in an ROTC program at Syracuse, and he is pretty solidly, you know, conservative. He's met some good friends that share his values and involved in the Young Republican Party and so forth. So he's pretty solid. And my daughter is also at UMass Amherst, which is obviously a large public institution. But since going there, she's conservative, and she's, you know, managed to, you know, have some conservative friends there. She's really embraced her faith. The church, there's a Catholic church somehow that's probably about 200 yards from her apartment, and she goes to Bible study, and she's going to a retreat in New Hampshire this weekend. Like, and this is all, you know, I mean, they do have a background faith. We have a strong Catholic faith, and they did go to Catholic school, so I think they had that foundation. But we are just really pleased that they that they've embraced it.
What's your advice to Steve, though? Because like you have that base, but that's not enough. Not always. It's not always enough. You know, you could send them off, and they could still spiral sideways.
I guess we're lucky. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Or you did a great job, but maybe you could still have done a great job, and it still doesn't. Like, I don't know.
Right. So, no, I understand. I think we are lucky. I think they've each made friends with who are
the same values,
politics, if you will. But we're very fortunate. I do have one other little story. I have a younger brother who's he's 35, and he was always very, very liberal. Now, he lives in New York State. He worked at a marijuana dispensary, one of the only medical, you know, marijuana dispensaries. And that actually turned him conservative, because in New York State, when they were kind of doling out the licenses for these places, the governor said the first 800 had to go to like former people who were convicted of, you know, marijuana crimes or something.
Yes.
And so he saw it. And I think it just takes one little issue to kind of turn people and open their eyes, and then you kind of, the whole house of cards falls, and everything. You see the unfairness and the, you know, the bias and everything else. So,
that's an interesting experience. Well, what's your advice to Steve? So Steve doesn't know what to do with his kid, trade school or college.
Honestly, I mean, trade school is a great option. And I think if you just choose, you know, your school, you know, carefully, I think some of the Catholic schools or, you know, Jesuit schools, I think you can still, there's still some liberalism there too, but you have better odds, I think.
Yeah. Go Dolphins. I used to live near Lemoyne. That's why.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You're an upstate New York guy. Yeah. Yeah.
Tracy, I appreciate the call. Let's go back to Steve. Steve, what does he want to do? What's your kid? Oh, sorry. Let me pull up Steve. Steve, what does your son want to do? Does he want to go to college, or does he want to go to trade school, or is he totally up in the air, 50-50?
Well, he's 50-50, either going to trade school to become a welder or B, going to the marine biology program, which is what terrifies me and the people in that
groups,
college.
Right? I wonder, like, also just – it seems like being a welder – it's just a better career decision than, I don't know, like how many marine biologists go on to be dolphin trainers at SeaWorld, which is like the cool job.
Thank you. That's the conversation we have many times over a dinner table. Like, I don't want you to be, no offense to high school science teachers, but yeah, I want you to, you know, spread out in the world, but, you know, welding will take you all over the globe, son.
Yeah, welding seems more stable. We're always going to need welders. You can't AI welder. I did. I lived in San Diego, so I actually did get to chat. I know the head killer whale trainer over there, but there's only one of those guys. There's only one killer whale trainer guy who's like, right. That seems like a tough gig to get. I don't know what else marine biologists do. Yeah. So even just career wise, I don't know, Steve. I feel really bad. I don't know what to do, and And when you send your kid off, what do you do then? You know, you just hope you did a great job. Like, how confident are you with how well of a job you did in grounding your son in this stuff?
My wife and I are confident about how well we've grounded our son. However, as my wife says, he's going to find some chippy in college, and that's it. Yeah. So that's
what happened to Colin Kaepernick. Colin Kaepernick was like a normal guy, grew up. He was adopted, white and black. Adopted parents. And then he went and he met this activist gal, and he turned into Malcolm X. So that is a concern. I don't know how many of those ladies are at welding school, though. So you may be safer in that regard as well.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, Steve, I wish I knew, right? I appreciate the call. I'd love anyone else advice. Clearly, I'm a loss. I don't know what to do. Let me take one more call. Then we'll take a break. Go to Rich, who's in South Carolina. What's going on, Rich?
Hey, Mike. Good morning. Hey, love the show.
Thanks, Rich.
A real light moment here for you and your audience. Let's dial it back from college to elementary school. Mike, did you make the 40-minute journey to bring Jack's backpack to school?
Okay, so if you missed, was it yesterday?
It sent chills down my spine when I heard that. You know, my kids, their school is a chipping wedge down the road, so they walk or ride.
Yeah.
And when I get that call from school and I'm sitting on a Zoom conference call saying, "Hey, Dad, my lunchbox is in the kitchen." Oh boy, it's but you know, it's a life lesson, right? It's accountability, it's preparation, it's thought. A light moment, Mike. But I'm just curious.
No, I appreciate it. So I used to walk to school too. So back in the day, it was no big deal. I went to school too. You could leave campus. You just like leave and like run home and leave. So what would you have done? So he's seven, first grade, 40-minute drive. He left his backpack at school, everyone, or at home. So the wife would have had to drive 40 minutes back home, get the bag, either she or I drive another 40 minutes there to give it to him, which we don't want to do. We want him to learn the lesson, right? Like to struggle throughout the day. Like this stinks. Next time I'm going to remember my backpack. But also I didn't want to put a huge burden on the teacher, but by one of her students not having the backpack. So what would you have done?
You're right. And that's such a salient point around, you know, you're disrupting the entire group. I'll tell you, I would have been real ticked off. I would have brought the backpack. And the reason why is because I would have thought about my son all day. I think it would have distracted me. I would have thought about how upset he is, you know, how maybe he's thinking about how mom and dad will be upset with him when he gets home. So he would be distracted in class. He wouldn't be able to learn. So I would have sucked it up, driven, maybe canceled the meeting, took a call from the car, and I would have thought about how much it would have cost me in gas and all that. But I would have brought the backpack because it would have derailed my day.
That's great. Yeah, we didn't bring the backpack.
Okay. All right.
That's great. Rich, I appreciate the call. We called the teacher and asked her, and she's like, no, don't worry about it. It's fine. So he had to copy every worksheet himself and redo it. So when I picked him up, he was frustrated, but also like pretty proud that he did the extra work to catch up and stay caught up. And he showed me all the papers that he recopied and did all that stuff. So we did it because if the teacher said, "Ugh," then I would have been like, "Oh, enough said. We're back, whatever." But the teacher's like, no, it's fine. It happens. Everyone forgets it once a year. Something like that was her line. It's like, this is our one, whatever. Sorry. So we didn't bring it back.
I'm American made. I got American parts.
Thanks for listening to Breitbart News Daily. Maybe we'll do the hour we were supposed to do today instead. About what's going on our college campuses. It's getting worse, and it's invading. I mean, it is in the Democratic Party, but now they're protesting outside of Chuck Schumer's house, which is great. So we'll talk more about that. Also, Sebastian Gorka, of course. It's tomorrow's Thursday. Can you believe it? Tomorrow's Thursday. So Dr. Gorka at 8 o'clock. We'll see you then.